and she pulled the trigger. I could just make out the flechette as it passed to my left. She attempted to correct her aim and lead me, and I reversed direction. The second shot went past me on the right. I dove to the ground and slid into her legs, and she went down on her face. I jumped up, grabbed the gun, grabbed my backpack, and stopped. Looked at Motorola. Bender. Ah, what the hell? I grabbed the radio, tucked it more or less under my arm, and made for the door. Just as I got there, the door opened to show Jeeves, his face finally registering something other than disdain. I straight-armed him with the backpack and ran over him as he toppled. Right into a roomful of Quinlans. The group who'd grabbed me in the first place looked up from their meal. Apparently Jeeves had followed through on the offer of nourishment. A frozen moment of mutual inspection was broken as they all jumped to their feet, plates and food scattering in all directions. The cleaning staff would have their work cut out for them. But meanwhile, I had a backpack in one hand, a gun in the other, and an antique radio under an arm. This would severely limit my fighting ability. Time to take a cue from all those Jackie Chan movies. I hooked a footstool with a foot and flicked it at one of the hench critters, then tossed the radio to Frida. I jumped at the third and knocked him over before he could react, then grabbed the radio back from Frida and bashed it into the face of the first. He fell over backward onto a side table, smashing it. Natasha was not going to be pleased. Frida took the opportunity to grab a convenient short sword and made to poke me with it. I parried with the radio, being careful to avoid having her stab straight into it. I needed the electronics in one piece. She stepped back and started edging toward the door. I wasn't sure if she was trying to get out and raise the alarm or prevent me from leaving. Neither was good. I put the radio on the table, grabbed a couple of plates, and flung them at her, frisbee style. One missed, the other struck her in the thigh, and I learned a new Quinlan swear word. Nope, several. Must have heard a lot. But that was my chance. I grabbed the radio, then stopped. Lying in the wreckage of the side table was what looked for all the world like a security card. What would a pre-steam-level society need? Didn't matter. If there was one thing that years of adventure in D&D games had taught me, it was that anything and everything was useful and should be taken. One problem: not enough hands, too much loot, and too many opponents. The Quinlan on the ground was starting to get up, so I smacked him upside the head. Down he went for nappies. I grabbed another plate and beamed my erstwhile frisbee opponent, earning another curse word. I lobbed the radio in a high arc in the direction of the door, grabbed the security card, stuck it in my mouth, grabbed the trank gun, and charged for the door. I took a second to kick Frida's remaining leg out from under her on my way past, scoring bonus points and yet another swear word, and caught the radio as it reached the end of its arc. I hit the door with a shoulder, smashing the latchwork, and bolted down the hallway to the front entrance, trank gun in one hand, radio tucked like a football in the other arm, backpack held by one strap flapping up and down on my back, and card in my mouth. I was developing an appreciation for all the little details those adventure games had left out. At this point, though, facing the great outdoors, my plans got a little vague. I couldn't steal a car, or even a bike. And with the radio in hand, I couldn't go aquatic. That meant a straight sprint. The Manny would overheat quickly with that kind of punishment, so I'd need to be as far away as possible before having to stop. Well then, uphill. Quinlan's trying to take a water route would be swimming upstream, and Quinlan's engaging in a straight foot pursuit would eventually tire, plus they'd be much slower. I took off up the hill, radio held in a death grip against my chest while trying to both not bite through the security card and not drop it. 10 minutes of running, jumping, and dodging got me into a small copse not visible from Natasha's estate. I placed the security card on the ground and spit out my only remaining spider, instructing it to climb a tree and keep watch for approaching pursuers. Then I sat down to cool off and try to get a grip on my day. I took a few seconds to examine the trank gun. It looked exactly like the one that Garfield had grabbed. I guess there was just the one model. This one, though, had a full magazine, less the two shots Natasha had taken. The gun went into the backpack. Then I picked up the supposed security card. I had to admit to myself, that had been a huge leap to a completely unwarranted assumption. But the thing looked like a credit card or a security card, and it was on the end of a lanyard. Even the size and shape were... Huh. I'd never noticed it before, but the standard proportions for cards had always been pretty close to the golden mean. The golden mean occurred all the time in nature back on Earth, and it would appear that it was a universal of some kind, even to the point of influencing technological designs, which was all very interesting, but now was not the time for a deep philosophical soliloquy. I had no freaking clue what the card would be useful for, so at the moment it was moot. Into the backpack it went. Now, the radio. Bender? Nothing. I realized that the little indicator lamp was out, so no power. Very likely all the recent kinetics had done something unfortunate to the insides. 2 minutes later, I had the back open and was inspecting the innards. The technology resembled mid to late 20th century electronics. Still mostly discrete components, but a lot of large-scale integration on the circuit boards. Oh, and a couple of batteries that had been joggled out of place. Derp! I pushed the batteries back into their holders and turned the radio around. Bender? Hey, Bob. Long time no see. Talk. Holy God, am I glad to hear your voice, though. No video on this thing? No such luck, boss. The Resistance has enough trouble pilfering the components for an audio-only device. I have video in the room where they're keeping me, though, or I'd have gone completely crazy by now. So you're a Resistance fighter, are you? Meh. My choices are limited, at least until I can grow legs. Speaking of which, how is it that you are walking around as a Quinlan? You are a Quinlan, right? No one has mentioned you and your friends being hairless and tailless. I gave Bender a quick rundown of Bill's work with androids over the last century or so. He was suitably impressed. Now, your turn. How did you get where you are?
Yeah, that, Bender replied.
I was heading for Gamma Leporis A when I spotted an anomalous... I've already figured out everything up to the point where you got shot out of the sky. Let's fast forward.
Okay, oh impatient one.
I don't remember this part, of course, but I've been told what happened. The Heavens River Patrol bots shot me down because I guess I neglected to give the secret handshake. The administrator had them cut my matrix out of the wreckage and bring it back, where the Resistance managed to intercept the shipment and steal me. It turns out a significant percentage of crew are double agents. Anyway, the Resistance eventually figured out how to power me up, and since the administrator had included all my primary interface circuitry, we were able to communicate.
Wow.
And you volunteered to help them against the administrator? Well, volunteered is a strong word. The gist is that I could be a useful source of information, or I could be taken apart. I went for door number one. A reasonable choice. How realistic was the threat? Not as much as you'd think. The administrator controls everything and has all the tech. The Resistance has managed to stay mostly tech-savvy, and they have books, but it's been quite a few generations since they were part of a technological civilization. Stuff has slipped, you know? I doubt they actually had the tech level to reverse engineer an optoelectronic cube, and the administrator doesn't hold university courses for crew. They get the training they need to do the job they're assigned.
Yeah, look, we can continue this later. Right now, where are you? Is there any way I can bust you out?
Well, I can tell you I'm not in a town. People are always heading into town or coming in from town, so I'm at least some distance from it.
No mention of the town name?
Halep's Ending has been mentioned numerous times. Hopefully it's a town and not an epithet.
Crap. Never heard of it.
What else you got?
If it helps, I don't think we're too far from the town. Maybe a couple of hours for a Quinlan, and the room I'm in is very modern. Looks more 21st century than 18th, if you know what I mean.
Maybe some kind of high-tech hideout, and no windows or anything.
It feels kind of like an underground military base.
Damn.
I sat back, leaning against a tree-like thing.
Sesh, my translator interface informed me.
Then I sat forward as I got an idea. There was a transit station in the rail terminal. Surely they'd have, I don't know, some kind of map or transit listing or something. 1 billion miles of megastructure, that's a lot of towns. It's all we have at the moment, buddy, but we've noticed time after time that the Quinlans think and behave a lot like humans, so if they're mentioning Halep's Ending, there's a good chance that it's the name of the station as well as the town. Or maybe even only the station. Then I had a thought. 1 billion miles of megastructure, but Quinlans didn't have Scut, so light speed was a limiting factor for any communications using Quinlan technology. Bender, I need to test transmission latency. Can you frame Jack in your current situation?
Yep.
They powered up everything rather than trying to figure out what was and wasn't necessary. You want me to turn around a ping for you? Please. I cranked my own frame rate up as high as I could. Okay, 1, 2, 3, ping, ping. It's not traveling at light speed, Bob, because this isn't a radio broadcast. It's a packet-switched network running on the megastructure's backbone, so assume half light speed. Using the amount of time it took for Bender to return my ping, I calculated he was within 10 segments or so. The ad hoc ping method didn't allow any better accuracy than that, and I couldn't resolve a lower limit. Still, it meant that Bender was less than 10 segments away and reachable in less than a Quinlan lifetime. That was a big improvement from 1.8 million candidates. So assuming I find Halep's Ending, how do I find you? Look for the futuristic underground bunker? Thanks, that'll work. Actually, it does narrow things down, maybe. They seem to operate right under the administrator's nose. Is it possible you're occupying management territory? Actually, Bob, it's virtually certain. The resistance mostly survives by theft, stealth, and more theft. They have very little of their own technology. How are they doing this right under the administrator's nose? Beak. Oh, the administrator knows they're there. It could, in theory, obliterate the resistance in a day or two if it was willing to. Generally speaking, the administrator leaves them alone. That seems incompatible with scattering. Scattering keeps the majority of the population in line and keeps the tech level pristine. The one thing the administrator is consistently strict about is the technological level of the general populace. Other than that, it tries to interact as little as possible. So, trying to get rid of the resistance entirely would be like playing whack-a-mole and would draw attention to both the resistance and the administrator. And trying to vet each and every use of equipment over a billion-mile-long structure to make sure it's crew and not resistance is just too much trouble. So, the administrator ignores them, as long as they don't become too much of a nuisance. The administrator seems quite accommodating. Well, it doesn't have any choice. It's... Bender's voice cut off abruptly. There didn't appear to be any signal. Even background noises were gone. I had to conclude that Natasha had sent them a message and they'd cut him off. I hoped that was all they'd done. It was time to get the others involved again. My first priority would be to find a safe place for the Manny. The radio was no longer an asset, so I could leave it. The resistance might even give up the search if they found it. I placed the radio up on a rock so it would be visible from a distance, but hopefully without being too obvious about it. The roamer hadn't seen any movement nearby, although there was a hint of activity to the east. I remembered spotting a small stream in that direction, so that was a good area to avoid anyway. The Quinlans wouldn't stay out after dark in a wilderness area. As Bridget had pointed out on more than one occasion, this was more of a nature preserve than a zoo, and Quinlans weren't the largest things with teeth. So all I had to do was stay out of sight until sunset, then find a reasonably private spot. With scent and internal heat turned off, I wouldn't interest a predator. I ordered the roamer to hop aboard, spent 10 minutes or so putting some distance between myself and the radio, then dug into a corner by a rock outcrop and sent the roamer back out on sentry duty. A few broken-off bushes placed around me, and the roamer confirmed that I was well camouflaged. I lay back, closed my eyes, and returned to my VR library. Jeeves, showed up with a coffee and a snack. Spike followed immediately to check out the snack. I patted the cat while shooing her away from the little sandwiches, and realized I was stalling, without being sure why. Maybe there was enough going on without this extra complication. I sent out a connection request to Bill, Garfield, Bridget, Will, and Hugh. Bill and Will replied that they were busy, but Garfield would fill them in. Garfield and Bridget accepted the connection right away, but with Hugh, I got voicemail. Yes, actual voicemail. I'm not available for the next week or so. Please leave a message. If it's urgent, please contact. Now that was weird. But I would pursue it later. For now, I had Garfield and Bridget on the line. So, I guess you're wondering why you've gathered us here. Garfield cut me off. Funny thing, turns out it does get old after a while. Bridget added her full-throated laugh. Finally, someone agrees with me. I am maligned, I said. I have news, but my feelings are hurt. Hanging up now, I laughed. All right, guys, so, short version, I found Bender. This produced the expected explosion of questions. I waited for it to die down, then said, I'll give you all the audio record. I'm also going to blog it, but first I have to mirror my blog over to your side of BobNet. My bandwidth is bad enough without half the Bobiverse trying to cram through my temporary relay. I'll take care of that for you, Bob. I can mirror it easily enough. Thanks, Gar. One less thing to worry about. So now, there is bad news.
Isn't there always?
Yep. I lost contact with Bender soon after I found him. I think his captors cut off communications. But before that happened, we narrowed his location down to a stretch of Heaven's River within about 5,000 miles of me either way. We could eventually get enough drones with Sudar scanning into the area, but between the resource scarcity and the necessity of sneaking them and maintaining a heat sink, it might take literally years to find him.
But you can run that in parallel while you continue to search, so I presume you have a point,
Bridget said. Yeah, we don't know when we'll get back full control of BobNet. I don't even know if I'll be successful in getting my relay station back. If that fails, it'll be years before I can put another one in place. I need at least one other person on this side working with me, and I was hoping one of you might volunteer to clone. Or Bill when he has time to think about it. Otherwise, I'll do it myself, but You clone reluctantly, Garfield said. Yes, you are famous for that. It's the most efficient way to go, though, Bob. Getting a backup across your temporary relay will take a week, whereas you could have a backup done locally in no time.
Yeah, I get that, Gar, but
if I clone, they'll have to use your manis. I just wanted you to have first dibs.
I've already made my feelings clear on the subject, Bridget said. If your descendant wants to be a female Quinlan, go for it. Although I hope you'll choose one of the other ones. Eventually we'll get comms back, and I still want to explore.
Speaking of bandwidth, Garfield said, I've just started doing prelims on the mirroring, and your bandwidth sucks. I mean, even worse than you'd expect. Are you running a file transfer right now?
Not that I know of.
I'll look into it when we're done here. So let me know when you've got the mirror done and the name services redirected. I'll put up a blog post with all my audio and video files. Maybe it'll give Starfleet a collective coronary. Garfield snorted. If only. As soon as we all disconnected, I called up Guppy. Do we have some large bandwidth-sucking operation going on our connection to BobNet?
Transfer of backup image in progress.
What? Whose? On the one hand, that might mean I wouldn't have to clone. On the other hand, it might mean someone was trying to sneak in.
Expedition member, colloquially known as Hugh, has requested that we receive his backup. He also redirected printer operations to complete a single matrix on a priority basis.
Well, that was mighty presumptuous of him. Then again, I had given Expedition members the run of the place. He could have told me.
You were in remote operations. He left an email.
I resisted the urge to slap my forehead. Instead, I checked my inbox, something I kinda hadn't gotten around to yet. Yep, message from Hugh. With a sigh and a shake of the head at my own stupidity, I opened the missive.
Hey, Bob. It occurs to me that you need help, and your reluctance to clone is well known, so I've taken it upon myself to transport to Eta Leporis to help you out. The transfer will take a few days to a week, depending on other traffic, and I've instructed Guppy to concentrate on a single matrix to speed it along. I'll be offline until you bring me back up. I've attached a contact ID for one of my co-workers, in case of problems. Hugh.
Huh. Odd phrasing. And why would he be offline? Whatever, I had bigger things to deal with. Guppy, how many scanner drones can we get close to this segment of the megastructure? I inserted coordinates, without revealing our presence, and how fast? Guppy took several mils to answer, which surprised me. Normally, even I didn't notice his processing time, but this was a complex planning operation, mixing delivery times, heat sink limits, resource availabilities, and priorities of other projects.
6 months to move 4 units into position, 1 year for 12 units.
Oh, wow, that sucked. I had a feeling that Hugh's matrix had contributed significantly to that delay, but I would still rather have him around. How long to move 1 unit into position?
3 weeks.
Please do that.
Acknowledged.
So for the next 3 weeks, I was essentially searching blind. Even after that point, my single unit would have to scan up to 10,000 miles of Topopolis at sufficient detail to be actually helpful. I did not feel overwhelmingly hopeful. So, meanwhile, upstream or downstream? It came down to a flip of a coin. Hugh, when he activated, would take the other direction. Maybe I'd have some progress to show by the time Hugh's clone woke up, which might make it unnecessary for him to go the other way. Yeah, that's the ticket. But how to start?
2. A Second Visit. Will, July 2334, Vert, Vulcan Postlife Arcology. I knocked on Professor Gilligan's door, and it opened immediately. Stephen stood there, beaming at me.
Will, come on in. Good to see you.
I returned the smile as I entered. My eye was immediately caught by the window. Instead of the bishop ring that had been there last time, the view now showed a Topopolis. As with most such graphics, the scale was all wrong. In any view wide enough to take in the entire Topopolis, it would be invisibly thin. I nodded to the image. New project?
In a manner of speaking. I'm spending more time dissecting data from the expedition than doing much in the way of design. But I'm learning a lot. Future lectures will have to be modified.
Stephen waved to the couch and then sat in the easy chair as I made myself comfortable.
That's partly why I'm here, I replied, although there's more urgency about things now that Bob is on his own.
Stephen nodded slowly.
No doubt. The Bobiverse War is the biggest single news item in the UFS right now, even eclipsing the PAV threat. The level of emotion is, frankly, spilling over onto non-Bob replicant society. I've had to suspend my lectures for the nonce.
I'm sorry to hear that. Bill's all over it, though, and we're pretty sure we'll have things fixed soon. I don't know about back to normal, though.
I agree. This is one of those things that fundamentally changes a society, I think. Even after everything is repaired, it won't be the same as before.
Stephen hitched forward and called up a hologram.
Now, on to less depressing subjects. I've been analyzing the scans as they come to me. Thanks for including me in the chain, by the way.
He pointed to a part of the image.
This is interesting. There's a baffle around the central cylinder at every mountain boundary. It stretches downward about a third of a radius. It appears that the diaphragm-like mechanism hidden in the mountains would mate up perfectly with the baffle to close off the end of a segment. Presumably, this was useful during construction and would be used to seal off a segment in case of catastrophic failure.
Interesting.
Not immediately applicable to our situation, though. Well, maybe a little bit. It also acts as a light baffle to ensure that the sunlight from the next segment doesn't spill over. The segments alternate day and night, so only half are being lit at any time. A little more applicable. Sorry, Stephen, I shouldn't rain on your parade like this, but I'm focused on a particular problem. Stephen smiled to show he wasn't offended. Okay, then there's this. The baffle is wide enough to contain significant infrastructure. You mean like the infrastructure under the mountains? Exactly. I'd imagine it's probably more specialized for things that relate to the central cylinder, like power and holographic projection, though. And you'd access it how? Through the struts that run from the central cylinder to the segment boundary mountains. Wow. Okay. Additional areas to scan, and additional possible hiding places for Bender's matrix. Not what I'd call good news. Here's something that might be a little more helpful, Stephen continued. The vacuum monorail train network is quite extensive. There are express tubes that appear to run the length of the Topopolis, and they branch off into multiple levels for local stops. Interestingly, they wind around the inner shell, probably to counter the rotation. I'm sure you could calculate something from that. But anyway, if you can get onto a train, you can go anywhere. That would help, if Bob can just find the right city. 1 billion miles of Topopolis will. There must be a directory, probably staffed by a computer system. But we don't even know if the original plan included the cities that are there now. If crew needs to get to a given city, it will have been added to the list. Even if every single city isn't in the directory, the important ones will be. I raised my head. In fact, if a city isn't on the directory, it's probably not worth checking out. That would be a reasonable conclusion, but not necessarily the converse. Got it, no assumptions. Anything else, Stephen? I think I've identified the entrances to the administrative area under the mountains. I can't get a lot of detail, but there's definitely something here and here. I looked closely where he was pointing. Sure enough, something that had to be an entrance was just a short walk from the river shore. Chances are it would be disguised in order to not break the illusion of wilderness, and not freak out the wildlife, of course. Nice. I'll pass that on to Bob. He might decide to check out the administrative section just on principle, assuming he can get in. I'm sure there will be security of some kind. Also, and I'm not sure how relevant this is, but I don't think I realized how artificial a megastructure environment truly is. Not viscerally, anyway. The amount of maintenance, oversight, and surveillance required to ensure that, for instance, land or riverbed isn't eroded down to the bare shell is truly mind-boggling. The number of interacting factors that would have to be integrated, the point being... Stephen waved a hand in a dismissive gesture. First, it's virtually certain that your friends have been on camera, so to speak, and likely more than once. On the other hand, not every input can be given the same priority, so there's a good chance they haven't been noticed. Yet. But if the administration of Heaven's River is able to specifically identify the expedition members and decides to do an overt search for them, it's only a matter of time. They can't stay out of camera range, not even by going cross-country. Huh, I thought for a moment. I'm not entirely sure if that's good or bad. I stood. Thanks, Stephen. I'll update Bob on these items and we'll see if we can work it to our advantage. Any time, Will. Without my lectures, I'm at loose ends anyway. I hope the Bobiverse War is over soon. I'd like to be able to visit Heaven's River. You and me both. 3. Up the Creek. Bob, July 2334, outside Three Lagoons.
So, the mountains?
That's right, Bob, Will said. According to the prof, they're fake. I've asked the Skippies to get a closer scan of a mountain range just to get a general idea of the layout. There are no drones in your immediate neighborhood. I know. Already went through that exercise. I'm working on it, but it's slow.
Right. Anyhow, when you get close, we can work out a strategy for getting you in.
Assuming there's any point.
The resistance seems to live under the nose of the administrator, but I'm still skeptical.
What makes you think the resistance will be there?
Things like power requirements, access to resources, and access to the administrator's domain in order to be able to steal Bender in the first place. I talked to the gamers about this, and they agree that the best way to hide the resistance is right under the enemy's nose.
Maybe in D&D, not sure about real life, but it's a place to start, I guess.
First, though, I have to find Halep's ending.
True, which is where the monorail comes in if the town turns out not to be close by. Keep me updated.
Will hung up and I reached for my coffee. I'd probably be spending a lot of time in real. Best to get my fix while I could. I sat up and examined my surroundings. Nothing had been disturbed and my Manny still had all its appendages.
Excellent!
I glanced up, got my bearings, collected my sentry, and headed for the small stream I'd avoided last time I was moving about. I noticed on the way that the radio was missing, so my pursuers had seen it, which meant they'd been searching diligently. They might still be out there, in fact. I dropped to all fours, which I really should have done in the first place. Quinlans, like Pav, were more comfortable locomoting quadrupedally over any kind of distance. Only the Manny's design allowed me to overlook the inefficiency. I prairie dogged occasionally, keeping my head up for the minimum amount of time to get a 360 of the area, but saw no one. Eventually, I made it to the stream and slipped in. Swimming downstream was virtually effortless, and I took the opportunity to relax. Only the occasional twitch of the tail or flick of an arm was necessary to maintain bearing, and the stream never got shallow enough or tight enough to present an issue. This being a manufactured environment, it was probably a design requirement for all streams. And naturally, the resistance would expect a Quinlan to take the stream down to the river, so I shouldn't have been surprised to run smack into a net stretched across the deepest part. Cleverly braced asymmetrically, the net spun me as I was snagged, wrapping me neatly like a sausage. Immediately, I felt a tug as someone started hauling the net to shore. I strained against my bonds, but the cords were too strong, even for Manny's strength. I couldn't use my fleas, they'd be swept away by the current. Even my spider roamer might not be able to hold on. But what choice did I have? I spit out the spider, and it began cutting the net, concentrating on the strands that were under tension, hauling me toward shore. I almost made it. I had part of a leg free and one whole arm. I would have loved to be able to pull the trank gun, but it was in the main pouch of the backpack. Bad planning on my part. I think the resistance people must have decided they couldn't take any more chances with me. Before I was even properly beached, one of the waiting Quinlans waded into the water, drew his sword, and stabbed me in the leg. I screamed, and it wasn't all acting. I had the sense to turn the sensory filter up, but there is something about being stabbed that has a huge psychological component. It's a massive violation of personal autonomy. I hadn't felt that much fear since perhaps the moment of my death.
"Maybe that'll slow you down,"
he growled, and I realized it was Popeye, all fresh from his recovery and presumably looking for payback. He raised the sword again, and a voice I recognized as Frida's barked an order. Popeye snarled but withdrew the sword, then leaned forward.
"Just give me an excuse, and I'll finish the job."
Then he made a mistake. Again. The guy just couldn't seem to learn. Popeye extended his sword so the point was at my nose and opened his mouth to taunt me some more. At that exact moment, my roamer cut the last strand, binding one arm. I reached out at android speed, grabbed the sword around the hilt in a palm and fingertip grip, and jammed it backward to strike under his chin.
As he fell over with a howl, I threw the sword hilt first into the face of the second henchman, whose name I'd never bothered to learn. I'll give Frida her due. She had guts. Without hesitation, she pulled her sword and came at me. I still wasn't free enough to run, and I was out of handy weapons. I'd never get my knife or the gun out of my backpack in time. So I did the next best thing. I picked up Popeye and shoved him straight at her. Both went down in a heap with twin oofs. That gave me just enough time to remove the net and dive back into the water. Well, stagger back in. I'd forgotten about the stab wound and all the excitement, which in itself is a statement I would never have thought I'd make. The repair systems had almost closed the wound, but I was still leaking fluid, blood. However, I couldn't use the leg until internal repairs were complete, and I calculated that with the handicap, I wouldn't be much, if any, faster than a biological Quinlan. I submerged and began swimming, using only my tail as much as possible. It occurred to me that if they had anyone downstream, maybe with another net, I'd almost certainly be caught and go through a repeat of the confrontation I'd just endured. Leave the water? That would probably result in an extended game of cat and mouse with me trying to get to the river and them trying to intercept me. Like it or not, I was committed, but since I had a head start, I went ashore and took the time to maneuver my sword out of my backpack. If I was to be netted again, I didn't want to depend just on my roamer. While I was at it, I moved the trank gun to a side pocket that would be watertight, but could still be opened in a hurry. My roamer! A quick radio inventory confirmed the worst. I'd lost my last spider. It should still be well within range, even if it was still back at the fight, so I had to conclude that it had been destroyed or disabled. Nuts. This severely reduced my chances of getting out of a net. Time to reevaluate. Between losing my roamer and the leg wound, I was at a distinct disadvantage. I queried repair systems and found that the wound was significant. I was about an hour from full functionality, although fluid reserves would have to be built up as well, which could take a day or two and would require me to eat. This was definitely a good time to disappear, but I couldn't just park the Manny and leave it. If the upstream thugs came after me, I needed to be able to defend myself. That meant I'd have to stay with the Manny. So I could look forward to a long, boring time at the bottom of a stream. I took a minute to find a sheltered spot with some detritus piled up and proceeded to bury myself. Without the roamer, I couldn't check if I was effectively hidden, so I'd just have to take my chances. I waited almost 2 hours, just to be safe. This was way beyond the breath-holding capability of even the most athletic Quinlan, so if anyone was keeping watch up top, they'd have long since given up on me being in the area. But they wouldn't have to expend much effort with a net. Stretch it across the stream, sit down, have a coffee, wait for the lines to jiggle. Which meant I was going to have to hoof it. There was no way out of this that didn't involve a lot of time and effort and risk. With a sigh, I surfaced, glanced around, and scuttled into the bushes. 2 hours of skulking through forest, getting poked by thorns and sniffed at by random critters, finally paid off. I found myself peering around a rock at a couple of Quinlans relaxing by the stream. They had some ropes pegged to the ground and leading into the water. Three guesses what those were for. The question was, did they have anything I wanted, or should I just bypass them? I rolled my eyes at the thought. Name pretty much any movie with this kind of situation, and the protagonist would alert the pursuers with a bungled burglary, thereby provoking another chase scene and ensuing hilarity. No thanks. I took a moment to look around and plan my route, and headed back into the bush. After a long and circuitous hike, I finally made it to the river and swam out to where the other three Mannies floated at the bottom, anchored to a submerged branch. Despite the maintenance roamer's best efforts, the Mannies were accumulating something.
Mildew? Seaweed? Whatever it was, it made them look more like the swamp thing than Quinlan's. Hugh would have to do some cleanup when he finally activated one. I checked inventory, and thankfully Garfield had managed to get all the roamers back to their hosts. I ordered 2 roamers each from 2 of the Mannies to jump ship. Mouth open, I accepted the new recruits. One last item, money. We each had a fair inventory of the Quinlan coins, and we'd accumulated some Quinlan knives in the various encounters. Being metal, they were highly prized and worth as much as a year's wages for the average Quinlan. A quick frisking showed me that we had 7 knives total. I took 3 knives and a third of the cash from the other Mannies. This put me in much better spirits. I pushed off from the group and headed downstream. There was no way I could stay in 3 lagoons after the recent shenanigans. I figured I'd swim underwater for a half hour or so, then surface and take it easy while keeping watch for other towns. Being on the Utopia River system now, I would be going east, back into the Garak Spine segment where we'd started. It seemed like a step backward, although I honestly couldn't see how it would affect my chances at, well, anything at all. We hadn't been asking about town names, so we could easily have sailed right past Halep's Ending without even knowing. I found it lonely, though, floating down the river alone. I had to wonder if some of that was the Quinlan behavioral routines imposing a preference for company. As a rule, I tended to prefer solitude. Although maybe I'd gotten my fill of that for a while. The long trip out to Eta Leporis, along with the surprising changes that had occurred while I was out of touch, had made me feel more disconnected than I really liked. As if I was not just avoiding society, but actually being left behind as it evolved. Typical human inconsistency. If I was going to be a social pariah, I wanted it to be by my choice and on my schedule. Real mature, Bob. The sun was warm, though, and the water was never choppy. Small regular waves, more reminiscent of a lake than a river, slowly rocked me. Quinlan's floated like corks, or more appropriately, like otters, so the feeling wasn't a lot different from being on an inflatable air mattress. I dipped a paw into the water and paddled myself around to gaze east. Every 560 miles or so, Heaven's River had a mountain range circling the inside of the habitat. We hadn't understood the significance of that distance in the initial investigation, but it was obvious now that it was 1 day length for the artificial sun. The mountains and that baffle Will had told me about would help to keep the inhabitants from seeing a sun from the neighboring segment by providing a visual break. The circular ranges also provided anchoring points for thin spokes that ran up to the central shaft. No doubt there were power conduits and access tubes along those spokes as well, maybe even elevators for access. From the outside, the mountains looked like, well, mountains. Pretty impressive ones, too, probably designed to discourage climbing. Not that Quinlans were climbers by nature. Very soon the river would be passing through the gorge between segments. Then I would be looking for the next town. After that, it was back to the salt mines. 4. Played. Bill, July 2334, Vert. I stared at the listing results, my jaw hanging slack. I briefly considered having my jaw fall to my waist, but this wasn't the time for visual gags. Garfield had a grimace on his face that seemed to have been permanently etched on. His skin was almost gray, and I had a moment of admiration for the level of VR we'd achieved now that we were competing with Mannies. Starfleet root kitted, the standard image. Gar asked, "Looks like it." The standard Autofactory OS gets updated so frequently that it made sense to have a canonical version on Bob Hub. Or not, as it turns out.
I gritted my teeth to avoid sharing some choice curses with the universe.
Well, it explains how they got into the auto factories. Based on which ones they've taken, I'd say the rootkit was added about 10 years ago and added to source code, or it would have been overwritten on the next build.
Sounds right, I said, then frowned.
But 10 years?
Yeah, boss.
10 years ago. Starfleet was barely more than a discussion group. Plus, let's be honest, as a group, they just don't strike me as that smart. Look at some of the bonehead moves they've made since this conflict started. This smells. I wonder if it was something like Vickers and Vehement, someone with an agenda of their own, teaming up with Starfleet because their goals coincided.
This would have to be a Bob. A Bob who had diverged enough to want to do this but managed to keep it secret for literally years.
Garfield shook his head in disbelief.
I don't buy it.
You're very hard to please.
Garfield grinned at me.
Call me skeptical, call me cynical, whatever. The dots just don't connect.
Gotcha.
In any case, we have to deal with what we have. I'll call Will.
Will put his head in his hand and held the pose for several mils. Finally, he looked blearily up at me.
This is bad, really bad.
I know, Will.
The number of auto factories?
No, Bill, not just that. I mean, that's bad and all, but when meat space gets...
Oh, God, Will, meat space?
He gave me a sickly grin. Yeah, I know, you don't like derogatory labels, and you've mostly managed to put a stake through the heart of ephemeral, but I don't think you'll have as much success with this one. The relationship between digitals and bios has been getting more and more strained lately. It was going sour even before the Starfleet thing, but since that started, it's accelerated. When this hits the waves,
oh, hell!
It was my turn to put my head in my hand. Well, the good news is that we have an image with the rootkit removed that can be uploaded once you get control back, but it'll be a one-at-a-time thing.
Assuming there isn't a booby trap similar to the one in the space stations, Will replied.
Also, the planet-based factories won't have the same vulnerabilities, so the humans are less at risk than we are. They might continue to nuke all space-based auto factories just to be safe.
I'm not sure they'd be wrong, Will. We have enough sanitized units so we won't be dead in the water, but the amount of time it'd take to rebuild capacity?
Will nodded. Look, a significant reduction in autofactory production capability would have large economic impacts, even though the UFS claims not to count Bobiverse-owned autofactories in their monetary policy calculations, so they won't go off half-cocked. We'll have time to talk them down.
Let's hope. This is truly getting messy.
5. Hugh joins up. Bob, July 2334, Heaven's River. I could see a town on the shore of the river, perhaps a couple of miles downstream. The concentration of boats in the water was unmistakable. Normally, I'd just paddle up to the dock and poot out of the water, but I was feeling a little paranoid these days. It was pretty obvious by now that the Resistance not only had communication between towns far superior to the supposed technological limits, but they also had some kind of imaging technology. Either that or they were really good with wood carvings. In any case, it was likely to the point of near certainty that one or more agents were staking out the dock area, wood carving in hand, looking for me to pop up. So, perhaps a landward approach would make more sense. I came ashore a good mile upriver, wading my way through the shoreline swamp with muttered curses, both Quinlan and English. Now I needed a bath. Why did plans always have these unintended consequences? A bit of searching revealed, no surprise to anyone, that the swampy area was fed by a small stream, not big enough for Quinlan travel, but certainly big enough to clean oneself in. While I was squeegeeing the last of the muck off, I got a call.
Hey, Bob, you on channel?
Hugh?
You're online?
I am. Your guppy just booted me up. I'm taking up space in your cargo hold right now. I hope you don't mind. I'll manage. Hold on a minute. I'll get my Manny hidden and pop back to Vert. I spent several minutes looking around, then finally decided to just put the Manny underwater. There was unlikely to be any random traffic, given the size of the stream. I wedged myself under a submerged tree trunk, then left the Manny on standby and popped into my library. Hugh was sitting in a luxury gaming chair from the days when nerds played video games for 18 hours straight. I'd always been mildly surprised that no one had figured out how to put toilet functions in those things. Then remembered that no one had, as far as I knew. Hugh raised a coffee and salute as I sat down in my lazy boy. Jeeves came over with a cup for me, and Spike raised her head from the vantage of Hugh's lap to give me an arch look, loyal as ever. "So what will I call you?" I asked. "Hugh will do, same as always." The convention is to rename yourself. Avoids confusion. There won't be any confusion, Bob. There's only the one me. I had myself shut down before a backup was taken and the Matrix was wiped as soon as I was verified to be up and running here. There's no duplication and full continuity. I considered that for a moment. Like what Bridget was talking about a while back. You've basically transported yourself here. And you're okay with this? In fact, we have taken to calling it being transported. I was surprised when Bridget brought it up. I actually checked with my coworkers to see if she'd been talking to anyone, but apparently it was just a case of parallel thinking. He paused, collecting his thoughts. So this whole question of identity has been a philosophical hot potato since before original Bob was born. Since before Star Trek TOS, in fact. We, by which I mean the Skippies, have been working on it for a few years now, and I think we've made some progress on an objective resolution. Seriously? I haven't heard anything. We've been pretty closed-mouthed about the results. It has some implications, you know? My eyebrows rose. Yeah, that's not dramatic. Give. Hugh took a sip of coffee and got that settling-in look. Okay, you know how replicative drift means clones are always a little different from their immediate parent? It was a rhetorical statement, of course. He paused, waiting for an acknowledgement, and I nodded. Well, we did some experiments with volunteers and discovered that if you go through the transporting process like I just did, there is no change. Wait, you mean the clone is just like the original? How do you know for sure? We can't know to a mathematical certainty, of course, but personality tests applied to large numbers of parent-child pairs can establish a statistical level of expected drift. And within those limits, when we transport, there's no drift. At all. Yeah, but what if you activate the parent matrix after the child has been activated and tested? Hugh grinned at me. That's the interesting part. The parent then displays a statistically significant level of drift from his previous test score. What the fuck? I goggled at Hugh at a total loss for words. I sputtered several times before regaining control. So the parent is no longer the parent. The former parent becomes the new Bob. And we've run this through several generations, having both parties clone out their own descendant trees. The results are consistent. But how? We have theories, of course. We think it's a form of information entanglement, and I use that word on purpose because the decoherence is not limited by light speed. We've tried this experiment with the two versions being separated by light minutes. If we activate them within seconds of each other, the first one activated is always identical in behavior to the original. Like the first one up gets the soul, and the other one has to get a new one, Hugh laughed. That particular interpretation has been expressed a number of times, but I think everyone just considers it a metaphor. And the real explanation? We have two competing schools of thought. The first group thinks we're in a simulation, and the simulator can't handle two separate but identical objects. Maybe there's some kind of quantum signature that has to be changed. Poor programming, if so. Hugh nodded, a grin lighting up his face. Design decisions, right? Anyway, the second group thinks that replicative drift is caused by the no-cloning theorem. In other words, the second Bob isn't identical to the first because it would violate quantum mechanics.
He gazed pensively into middle distance for a few mils.
It has been further suggested that if the no-cloning theorem is applicable to replicants, then the no-deletions theorem probably is as well, and you know what that implies.
Life after death?
Yes. It also implies the possibility that you personally aren't just a copy of original Bob, but an actual restore of his mind, soul, whatever you want to call it.
Hugh paused with a thoughtful expression.
This is why we're working so hard on developing a true AI. We need something with actual counterfactual capability and a truly huge processing capacity to try to answer questions, just like this one.
42.
Nyak nyak, but a stupidly big AI could run through billions of possible explanations and narrow it down to some small subset that we could potentially test. And in its spare time, maybe invent FTL or something. We think it's the most important project the Bobs have ever worked on since the war against the others.
Hugh looked for a moment like he was going to add something else, then clamped his mouth shut.
There was that behavior again.
Either he had some kind of tic, or he really badly wanted to say something and couldn't. I blinked, coming back from my momentary distraction. Okay. This sounds like a discussion subject for those long stretches between systems. For now, let's deal with the immediate issue.
Right, I read your notes, and I did a quick inspection of the Mannies. You just cleaned them out of roamers, didn't you?
Not quite. There's like two left in each. Really, you should just take the spare. You'll be a while catching up with me if you head in my direction, and if you go in the opposite direction, we'll be doubling our search efforts.
Should I even try to link up? I mean, it's not like we form a proper sabbat. Maybe we should just leave it at doubling the search.
I thought about it for a moment. Compromise. Head in my direction, and if we do link up, we can make a decision. If one of us turns up something specific regarding Bender's location, we'll reevaluate.
Good enough, Hugh stood.
I guess we're winging it again. He winked out. I spent several mils staring at the space where he'd been sitting. Souls. Life after death. I wondered if, after all these years as a humanist, I'd end up eating my words.
6. The war heats up.
Bill, July 2334, Vert.
Things are getting a lot more interesting, Garfield said without preamble as he popped in. I turned and gave him the side eye. Gar was turning this unexpected popping in thing into a habit. Maybe it was the stress. I hoped so. I didn't want to have to make a big deal out of it.
How so?
I don't think Starfleet took into account the reaction of humanity in general. I think humans are looking at it like being snubbed because there's a whole I got you no contact with humans right here vibe going on. Any assets that any member of Starfleet might have had are being frozen. Agreements are being canceled, their access is being removed for everything, and even in systems that weren't affected by the network attack, they're being denied access. Basically, the entire infrastructure of human space is now being closed off to them.
I thought about that for a second, then laughed.
Their mission statement is to end contact with bios in general, but I think maybe they were planning on doing it on their schedule. Like when you give your employer 2 weeks' notice and they say, no, that's okay, leave now.
Yep.
And several systems have kludged together temporary comms stations, then immediately gone and taken down the originals until they can clean them out. Bandwidth suffers, of course, but for Starfleet, it drops to a big zero. As the number of available routes shrinks, we're able to come closer to pinpointing Starfleet's center of operations.
They have an actual center?
Well, they're pretty distributed, but the individual subgroups aren't very effective once they've been cut off from the collective. Most of Starfleet activity does appear to be coming from comm nodes in the direction of the Perseus transit, which jibes with my original estimate.
But they'll rebuild their comms stations as well. Eventually, we'll end up with two independent but overlapping networks.
If they don't have a physical presence, they won't be able to, Garfield argued. How are they going to rebuild?
No one's going to rent printer time to them. They'd have to fly someone in and then trust that whatever they build won't get shot out of the sky.
He had a point.
Yeah. I don't think there will be a lot of tolerance for Starfleet equipment, Garfield nodded. And assuming we are reduced to physical violence, we can expect a lot of hit and run. One thing we Bobs proved is that you can't maintain physical border security in interstellar space. Notwithstanding the Battle of Sol, which only worked out because we knew the others were coming.
That may not be viable in the long term, Gar. Imagine years and years of a running guerrilla war.
We may have to clean house.
7. The Battle of New Home. Claude, July 2334, New Home Colony. I examined the battle status graphic, searching for weaknesses. Commander Hobart stood at parade rest with that peculiar ability of the military to just go into mental hibernation when waiting. I found it ironic that he did a better impression of a machine than I would ever manage. I could leave my Manny parked under AMI control, but that would be cheating. I think we're covered, Commander. I shifted to face him and he came to life.
Then we're ready to go.
Hobart touched the emblem on his chest.
Miller, commence operation.
I suppressed a snicker. Apparently without any irony, the New Home military had adopted a comm system very similar to TNG. I'd questioned Hobart about it without being obvious, I hope, and he'd displayed no knowledge of the existence of Star Trek, let alone of the blatant borrowing. No double chirp, though, that would have been too much. Lieutenant Miller, somewhere in the vast maze that was the New Home military, would now be giving orders and activating equipment. As always, when I took the time to think about it, I found myself mildly surprised at the size of the military presence in the Gamma Pavonis system. Of course, New Home was founded when we were still not sure if the others' threat was over and the attitude had stuck. Maybe in a few more generations it would fade, but for now, New Home society was like a porcupine, perpetually on full alert. Today we would be going up against the Starfleet incursion in the system. Starfleet had taken over the local relay station and one of the two space-based auto factories, then contacted New Home to negotiate an agreement. From other negotiations with Starfleet, we had a pretty good idea of what they wanted. Agreement in principle that humans and replicants should go their separate ways. Agreement that there would be no contact with pre-industrial species. And agreement that interaction with post-industrial species would be kept to a minimum to avoid cultural contamination. In the face of it, the deal points didn't sound like much. In return for nothing except a bunch of signatures, essentially, Starfleet would hand back control of the equipment. Except that no matter how you phrased it, it was still extortion. Humans had never taken extortion well at best, and New Home society came nowhere near to at best. They hadn't even bothered to respond.
3 minutes,
Miller's voice said from midair. Hobart nodded in satisfaction, still at parade rest. As I watched, the little icons crawled across the graphic as the military units approached their targets.
You have 1 hour to reacquire the space station, Claude,
he said to me. This wasn't news to either of us. It was just Hobart making what he no doubt thought of as conversation.
The nuclear device will be put in place immediately, pending results.
Understood, Commander. I doubt you'll need the nuke. My understanding is that failure on our part will result in a self-destruct. Hobart smiled but didn't reply. The assaults were timed so that we would intercept the autofactory and space station at the same moment. We wanted Starfleet's attention to be divided. Not that it would make a ton of difference, but every little bit helped.
No sign of resistance yet, Miller said.
Odd, Hobart frowned. They've had control of the autofactory for 2 days now. Shouldn't they have been able to construct at least a few of your busters by now?
Yes, Commander, and they should have launched...
Bogies detected.
Miller interjected.
That's more like it. Hobart tapped his emblem. Details, please.
Busters, from the look of it. 20. Straight attack vector, no subtlety.
Hobart gave me a perplexed look. Eugens tend to be tricky as a rule, but that sounds like the maximum they could have built in the available time. Any chance there's a fake of some kind?
I don't see how, Commander. You're right about the numbers. This looks more like a last-ditch effort or a simple act of defiance. I'd have waited longer to get our forces closer together.
Amateurs, Hobart muttered. Miller's voice supplied updates every few seconds in a flat, unemotional tone.
Units engaging. First wave, enemy casualties 50%. Second wave engaging. Second wave through, only two enemy units still extant, deploying spikes. Field is now clear.
Well, that was it. Unless Starfleet had a Kree battleship up their sleeve, we had a clear path to the target.
Last chance, Commander. We might still save the auto factory.
He shook his head. Not worth it. Too much risk of buried malware. Even your skippies couldn't guarantee a total cleansing. We'll rebuild.
And the fact that it was the auto factory technically owned by the Bobaverse was undoubtedly a factor. I wondered if they'd have been so quick to write it off if it had been the new home-owned equipment. At that moment, a harsh buzzer sound shattered the silence, and Miller's voice announced,
"Space station detonation, not our action, appears to be a self-destruct."
"Crap," I said. I turned to the commander.
"I'll examine the logs, and maybe we'll learn enough to avoid this next time. Your backup ready?"
He shook his head.
24 hours from go live. We didn't feel we could wait. We have individual small scut units with the necessary range, as I'm sure you do, but not enough to maintain full connectivity. We're essentially isolated from the rest of the UFS for a day.
Hobart gave a humorless, perfunctory smile.
No big deal from a practical point of view, but you know the big heads will have a collective fit. Can't block commerce and all that tripe.
Yep, I rolled my eyes. That's okay, Commander. I think we're already at Max Doghouse. This won't add anything. Commander Hobart gave me a nod, then turned away and began giving orders to Miller. I took that as my cue and headed for the exit. I normally kept this Manny at the new home capital, a convenient location for interacting with the government or catching transit if I needed to go into town. However, knowing how this engagement might end, I decided to plan for getting the Manny off-planet. Howard had warned me that the very human tendency to want a scapegoat was making life uncomfortable for in-system Bobs everywhere. My assets, those that were liquid anyway, had already been transferred via inter-system banking in transactions that couldn't be unwound. My physical assets were already heading out